Okay, so this we've worked our way through. This is Life in the Labyrinth. We're on chapter 17, and we worked our way through the bulk of the material in this book. This material is one individual's effort to attempt to reduce to words the unspeakable in a certain way, to attempt to give some indication of what it's like to be and to work and to move in the Bardos. This is unique in itself, and therefore, and yet we respond to it when we listen to this material. We know and feel that it's something that's important to us, and that's why we're going to continue here. No, we do not understand it in full. No, many of the experiences are beyond, maybe beyond our full scope, but they're not totally beyond it. Okay? They are within reach, and that's why our hearts and minds respond to it, because it's, we can sense it. That's what we have today. So if that's what you have, you work with what you have. And I think that's the effort that's before us. The more excellent there is something that you want, the more excellent the object of your desire, the more work it's going to be. And as our buddy Spinoza says, all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. That is the case. And you can almost always count on the issue that, yes, you're going to have to work a little harder. So here we are, chapter 17. And throughout, we've been being introduced to this idea of bringing creation to life, and that's the name of this chapter 17. And part of that has to do with the fact that our essential self, when we are an essential self, we are a microcosm of the Godhead. We are God on earth. As long as we are in that space, that is who we are. That is the space in which we persist. So we're experimenting with what does it mean to be in that space, all right? The effort to bring creation to life is never-ending. At first distant, the actual possibility of performing this task will be achieved again and again during our work in the labyrinth. This talk is a reconstruction of a successful group voyage. Often I haven't really wanted to work on the chapters where it's someone's personal experience, but I think a few people have indicated that they would like that. So we're going to go through this chapter. And Susan, I think you were one that was interested in this particular chapter, so let's see what questions we come up with.
Actually, we have a first question, which I think is a question I have too. Path World is saying that I don't get it, that the creation is dead.
Most, I don't know, and George, you know, help me out here, but I'm going to take a shot at something, and maybe you can help me by expanding on it or giving a better answer. But when I look around me, most of what I see is sleep. It's a dismal reflection of the higher spaces that I get into when I'm in a more unique space. And I, in a certain way, I take it literally that which is around me is on a lower level of life. There's a lower, by that I don't mean superiority or whatever, but I just simply mean that there's less vitality, there's less vibrancy most of the time. And when we can get to this place of enlivening ourselves, we are a spark that helps ignite other sparks. Because when we are in that space, we have an emanation that occurs. And yet it's an emanation that is reflected and understood by others. They suddenly recognize you. And that's why I've said sometimes in the past that when we go, like, if you can hold your inner space when you go into someplace like a market, certain people will notice you. That's what I'm talking about. So I don't know what else to say about it than that. And I don't know that I have that much of a clarity either.
You know, Dave, I think this is kind of based upon the idea that the creation is comprised of a series of octaves from the very highest, the absolute, which is vibrating at the fastest frequency and therefore the most intelligent. And then as you descend through these octaves of cherubim and seraphim and on down through angels and so on, powers and principalities, and you're going down these octaves, and the frequency of vibration of each octave, of course, doubles and therefore becomes more dense and less intelligent. So that by the time you get down to the world that we're a part of, the frequency is so slow as to be as if inanimate and dead from the point of the view of the absolute.
Right.
And as we begin to work on the development of our essential self, what we're attempting to do is climb back up the ladder of octaves to the higher frequency of the essential self, which becomes resonant with the absolute in the sense that everything below it, operating at a lower frequency like a rock, just doesn't seem to have much life in it. So what we're and this is, of course, for the world around us, but then we discover this is the fact with us as well. As our essential self grows and becomes an independent life force within us at a higher frequency, then it's able to perceive our own physical body and historical personality as really nothing more than slow molasses. And so our essential self, the task of our essential self, is to saturate our physical body with its own higher frequency of vibrations and bring our own physical body to life. And then in that case, our body wakes up, and now new powers are available to it. That's, I think, my understanding in answer to the question, in what way is a creation dead?
We don't have a consciousness big enough to understand all of creation. But we do have a consciousness to understand ourselves and, in fact, sometimes those around us. You have all had the experience whereby you're in this zone, this flow of a higher level of energy, and you go to speak to somebody else and there's a dullness. Not necessarily they don't understand you, but they clearly don't pick up what your state is. They can't grasp it. They can't get there. At the same time, you've had the experience when someone like wakes up because of that inner effort that you're making. And when that occurs, that's one micro inch of bringing the creation to life at that moment. Does that help at all, Susan, in Path World? Or is it just too much?
Well, it does seem to help. Because my computer, I just get a little bit of the chat. But Becky Sunnybrook was saying it's like a grade from very coarse to very fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and we want to work with a finer grade of vibratory sensation. And you can feel that sense of the fineness of it. Molly, when you go back onto the chat, raise your hand if there's a question, okay? Well, why don't you raise your hand and then when we work on that, we'll just...
The voice of the Holy Spirit.
But she can't see it.
Oh,
No, because she's traveling. She just has a very small window. Okay. Anyway, so let's begin. Let's just slide a little bit into the chapter, Susan. We'll come back to questions, okay?
Okay, very good.
Okay, so this particular chapter is then actually the description of an experience that an individual's having.
By the way, we don't know who this individual was, do we? Have you ever heard anybody mention who wrote this chapter?
Silverdale, it's not mentioned, or is it referenced anywhere in the chapter? Okay.
Okay, but, okay.
I came into the chamber around midnight, feeling quite exhausted. There was a light chatter between the three invocants, who seemed to be at an interval, and I went more or less unnoticed as I started preparing my bedding. I realized that EJ was preparing to voyage, and I immediately felt torn between participating or just going into my corner and sleeping. I might have to leave the room if I wanted to sleep. I really didn't feel like having a passive role as usual, and I wasn't interested in getting upset, knowing that my fatigue was already distorting my reactions and perception. So here's an individual, the end of their day, extremely tired. They go into this room and something's happening. They're just, I don't know if I want to go, I don't want to be, I'm going to stay, go, whatever. I reluctantly, remember this, joined the circle at the reluctant urging of those present, finally realizing that I would have to let go of my negativity. And of course the negativity is, I can't, I'm too tired, blah, 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 blah. This turned out to be much easier than I had expected, and we began to go macro-dimensional. From then on, I must admit, my early linear recollections are fuzzy. Time literally stopped. So here's something we've talked about extensively for the last several books, is that time in these spaces takes on a fundamentally different nature. It's not even part of the formula in a sense. We were in a timeless space, and I have no idea how long we worked or of the order of many of the events. I felt propelled into a series of cycles rather than experiencing a linear sequence of events. So that's a recollection after it was over, saying, here's a different way of looking at it. It wasn't this happened and this happened and this happened. It was a circular, it was a cycle. The only reference to time I remember had to do with what is called in the human sector a television set, which served as a communication device with other beings in the chamber. Early on in the voyage, it gave us this message, time is now. Now, many of you have had the experience where when you are in a more enhanced space, suddenly you see something and the meaning of it is very, very, very different. That it just has a different meaning because you're different. So note that sort of thing, that you become different because you're in a different space. So objects, sayings, words that you see have a different import into it. There's just different. And the meaning then exudes from it rather than being linear. Contrary to my habit of closely observing my surroundings and getting a general overview My attention was totally riveted to the nucleus of this particular macro dimension, to the extent that I have never lifted my eyes from it, although it did occur to me at least one point, take stock of everything. But I just couldn't bring myself to turn my attention away from what was happening in the center of the chamber. My surroundings simply did not have enough reality to warrant a deviation from my single pointed intention and attention. What do you think that means? Did you hear that, Susan?
Yes.
So what do you think the author means in that saying?
Well, it's a compulsion. It's like you have to go into that space.
You're compelled into it because there's, in a certain way, there's more reality there. There's more reality. You're moved into it in a certain way because you respond to it more. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and then that would add to the previous tiredness or reluctance would dissolve away by that compulsion.
Absolutely. And very simply, our surroundings right now, the atmosphere is that we have a bunch of fires around this Northern California area, and the smoke is intense. And it's so much in the atmosphere that it makes it very, very difficult. It makes it very difficult to breathe, walk around. You feel like a sore throat. But now I come here, I start doing this. Where's that feeling? So the body actually changes. The mood I experienced most of all was fluidity, smoothness. In a sense, it was as if everything was very relaxed, although this does not properly describe what I was feeling. It was almost as if I felt we were sailing. Rather than having difficulty or needing to make tremendous efforts to voyage from chamber to chamber. So this individual also aligned themselves with the particular mood of that workspace. They weren't trying to be in it. They weren't observing it. They acquiesced to it. And in that acquiescence, their attention actually added to the fire that was there, and that attention was part of what I call tending the fire. And they were properly doing that. My senses were not particularly sharpened, although not necessarily dull, perhaps slightly sluggish, without any feelings of heaviness. I had no sense of time once again. Everything was at a standstill. We started out as three, and everything felt remarkably smooth to me. EJ even commented that we had made a turn, that we had just made a really nice pass or landing or something to that effect. He cheered us on, and M added something also, an expression I was not familiar with. It was as if he was talking to an observer who should take note that we had not only done well, but had done more than was required. Anyway, it was a good beginning. It was during this interval that he also said that we needed B in the chamber. So M went out to see if she was in the house, but came back saying she was not. B did come in soon after that, though. I remember early on in the invocation that we were sitting in a circle. EJ expressed something with such finesse that I felt like clapping and cheering him on. It was a beautiful verbal tour de force that was such a delight to witness. I wanted to include it in Life in the Labyrinth. The idea he expressed was that perception perceptions usually lie in the macro dimensions, whereas sensations can usually be relied upon. And so, for some reason, for this individual, that seemed momentous. It had great meaning. So once again, there's that concept that when you're in that space, there's more meaning. And the meaning isn't an accumulation of linear data. And this is something that, you know, I see some of these Gurdjieffian fourth way chats, they go endlessly on. I just want to say, tell me the experience you're having. Are you having these kinds of experiences that these individuals are describing? Because you will gain, in a sense, perspective and meaning when you're there, and a depth of that meaning. That's what, and then you can bring that back out. You can bring that back out of that chamber. I was soon drawn in close, feeling quite compatible with what was occurring. I had taken to being more calm and hoping that things would work out rather than getting uptight, forcing myself to move in and out of spaces. I discovered that if I am relaxed, that I can ease into spaces. Although I do not have certain, I do have certain apprehensions that I might be too slow or not intense enough. So what's happening there? That individual is going into their head, right? Does that make sense?
Well, it seems like at that point it would be going away from the sensing.
That's right. And so they're saying, oh, gosh, I wonder if I'm doing it right. Is this correct? Nevertheless, I proceeded at the pace I felt comfortable with, not rushing. I was quite delightful and playful. I was reminded of times when we did dance together, and I felt we were making love or have wanted to make love afterwards. At another point, we interacted with a video monitor, which provided us with direction and cues. Video cues provided much interaction and was quite surprising. Don't write stuff like this.
Okay.
That's ridiculous. Don't write that.
Which one?
Look right there where it says, I. Here.
That was a comment.
Well, it's not. Okay, but if it's a question. Maybe I understand myself. But I'm not reading the time.
You'll get the chat later.
If it's a question, someone has a question, go ahead and raise your hand. And we'll stop and we'll investigate the question together, okay?
Okay.
All right, let's just do it that way.
Okay.
All right, thank you so much.
Dave, a number of people are asking you to speak a little louder or move closer to the microphone.
Okay, thank you so much.
Or somehow turn up the volume.
That seemed better?
That sounded good on my computer. I don't know how Gottfried and others feel.
Okay. A little later in the voyage, I had the feeling that I must have made a wrong move. Okay, where does that feeling come from? It comes from the fact that we are sensing, and we are sensing the vibratory fabric of the space, and then we feel that we've moved off it a bit. So the skill set is to say, how can I stay in this space? How can I stay in this space and be harmonious with that space? That's something that each of us can do even right now, is supporting the space as it is with the attention to the extent that you're able to. One of the questions had to do with one of the participants, they, whoever they were, wanted to know what was going on, if everything was all right. EJ indicated yes. In this space is like that. You sometimes do panic. You panic and you want to draw back into your ego self. your historical personality, and so you go out of the space in order to do that. When you do that, you start to fear. Fear starts to come up because you're generally in a very high space at that time. If you're in that high space, that means you're further from the regular mechanicality of the human biological machine, and there's fear in that body. This exchange is a very strong moment in the voyage and a good example of the type of phenomena that characterized it. The interaction with the television set was most astonishing to me. And EJ's ability to hold a conversation and take his cues from the audible input into the space was quite remarkable. So what the writer is talking about at this point is that you flip into the TV set and suddenly there's a scene or there's an ad and there's words sitting there and quote-unquote somehow it's directly in line with the space that's occurring at that moment. Part of that, it's magical in its own way to see that occur, but it does occur, and we can find instances of that from time to time. Several changes then quickly followed in rapid succession. Two voyagers at various points were instructed to view the television set as an audiovisual image display representing the ongoing workings of their head brain. It was pointed out to them that the TV would just keep playing in the corner. They were each asked whether they had to actually be, that is, diffuse their identity in the TV, and each one said no. Fine, we'll continue. He thanked one of them for letting us see inside her brain. The circle laughed. We all knew her very well. It was very funny to see how true this was. It really was her brain with its tone, interests, and habits. I was pulled in once more to the nucleus. I remember losing bodily sensation for a while and thinking I would have to continue voluntarily, and I did with no problem, but it really was because I decided to, and not at all automatically. The danger seemed most definitely present. One of us had to take the initiative to break what was happening. It seemed as if we got out of that one smoothly enough, although at another point things seemed to be a little more rough. In a different sequence, when I began working actively at the nucleus again, EJ instructed me that I should view the form I saw before me as dead. And this comes then to Pat's world and Susan's question, what do we mean? He stressed that I must not initiate any reaction or response unless it happened of itself from its own self-initiation, okay? From its own self-initiation. EJ was apparently not satisfied that the directives were clear to me, so repeated what it was he wanted me to do. He asked me if I understood, and I acknowledged. I repeated what he said, and he said that was exact. And then said we were taken off, which we immediately did. I would normally have asked a few more questions for precision, but felt that under the circumstances it would not be appropriate to dally in mental and verbal formulation. So I decided I had better fly by the seat of my pants. So is this helping a little bit? Susan, since you're there, I mean, is this the sort of thing that, are you sensing that this is something that you can understand? You could see.
Well, there are definitely some jewels in there. I think in some ways this chapter was a little hard because you know, the explanation was so long and it went into, well, I mean, the detail also gives you those little jewels about, you know, how not to go into your head and how to try to remain, you know, remain your sensing.
Yeah.
But it's almost like when you're telling a dream to someone, it's a little bit boring.
Yeah.
Does that make, you know?
I tend not to focus on these chapters, and there's often one or two in each book. I mean, each book generally has one, because in a certain way, it's very particular. On the other hand, if we read it in a certain way, it does allow us to sense the mood of that chamber and this particular individual's back and forth.
Right, and we all have that. Even, you know, the details of our back and forth are different.
Well, that's the whole thing that we have to establish here. We are not in this space. We are not in that particular space with these individuals and EJ doing something. That's not happening. So what do you do? How does your invocation occur? And if your invocation does occur, and how does it occur, what are those elements? Can you stay in it? Or do you get popped back out? Is it hard? Do you take advantage when you have others with you? And do those others, are they able to stay in the space in that same manner? So a lot of the principles that we've read in the first 16 chapters are being expressed here, but they're just like sand unless we actually put it into use on ourselves.
Yeah, I agree.
It had occurred to me that I might be utterly repulsed by the vision of a solid, eternally unbreakable connection to a dead lover, and had felt inside myself a mild apprehension about the possibility of rejecting what I would see, for I felt, which I felt would be very wrong, I knew that this was going to be for real, and that a faux pas could only be accidental, a result of what? A momentary inattention. So the concept of attention is very different in spaces like that. Your attention is enhanced. It's seriously enhanced. So you're not forcing your attention, but you're placing your attention. And if your attention wanders, it's because of something in your own personal ego and your personal machine. So this individual is realizing as a result that the mistake would be a result of inattention. Had I reacted to the vision and pulled away and rejected it, the creation, as it was in that dimension, would have shattered and fragmented into the tiniest possible units. This would have been a terrible downscale for it and myself. Any such reaction would have constituted a sudden move, something to avoid at all costs because, as we know, the consequences of actions in the macro dimensions reverberate down to the low. So these four principles that we learned several chapters ago about this idea of all phenomena is illusion, and you sense that space, and then neither attracted nor repelled, and then not making any sudden moves. So there's an art, a fine art of moving in and out of those spaces. Moving into the space, and then moving back out of the space elegantly. And this is in a certain form of elegance that we begin to do this sort of thing. Not making any sudden moves. I went into a relaxed mode, not wanting to initiate anything. I looked at EJ and he seemed so very different from anything I'd ever seen him appear to be before. I didn't know it, but I was going to see many things that I most certainly had never seen before. The sensing changes were the strongest elements throughout the whole voyage. They were subtle, but recognizable, definable, and distinctive. I was in the same place, only it wasn't the same place. Nothing new appeared in my perception, but the quality of the new surroundings, the characters, and the dimensionality were very different. I was struck by the scale on which things were taking place. This was not the human level. Although the creature in front of me had an identity, which I could conveniently assign to it, something familiar on a human level, but here it was something else. And it's okay to think about that when we go into those spaces, that it is something else, to think of, open the eyes, be in wonder, get a sense of it is something else, because there is a dimensionality of the spaces around us at all the time. But here was something else. We were on a macro scale. A lot was contained in us and depended on us. EJ appeared as an enormous creature. Enormous meaning the size of a universe or more. I could not really guess what he presently incorporated, nor could I fathom its limits. The enormity I experienced had nothing to do with visual changes. It was a qualitative change. I experienced the momentum and weight of this scale and guessed at his macro function. So this individual in that space sensed that EJ had a function, and it was, so there was a some sense of functionality at those spaces. That's a significant understanding for this individual. Yes, Molly. Can you turn this up more?
I'll check and see exactly how I'm at.
Okay.
Close into it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. I'll attempt to do that more, Godfrey. Thank you for that. So this whole idea of the macro function, this idea that when you are in those spaces, that's when you can begin to get a sense of what your macro function might be. But you have to spend a little bit of time there. You have to experience yourself there. You might begin to sense this idea of a macro function that you might possess. I did not feel or see anything particularly striking after that. Perhaps I was too phlegmatic or passive during that passage. In any case, it eventually ended. Although I do not recall how, I do remember not knowing when I should consider this particular instruction complete, and whether I was supposed to continue in the same mood as instructed earlier. So I maintain the attitude I believe to be appropriate. So things were happening around this individual. There was accelerations and deaccelerations, and the individual wasn't quite sure what to do. So not making any sudden moves, in a certain way, they let their habits carry themselves through in that particular moment. I'll just do what I believe to be appropriate. I changed places and became a passive observer. I remember lying on my side and with my full attention once again riveted to the central nucleus, feeling very connected to it. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, I saw what was in front of me as the creation, and plainly saw that it was dead. So that was the instruction that the individual got early on in their work chamber, that in this case, EJ said to the person, view this as what's before you as dead. And they couldn't quite get there. And now, suddenly, that became a reality to them. That became real, that they saw this as dead. It was as if I was looking at it, seeing it as an ordinary configuration. Then suddenly, during doing a double take, realizing it really was death. There was no detail to this perception, no added features. It was still the same chamber, the same cast of characters, but they were incorporating the totality of creation. And the whole thing was really, really dead. It was truly horrible, far beyond anything I could ever imagine, because it was real. It wasn't just a thought. So there was a direct perception occurring at those times. If you have a direct perception and you garner a particular type of meaning, doesn't mean then you have better understanding in your linear brain, because this isn't part of the linear brain. It's a different thing altogether. The vision was extremely brief, briefer than my usual insight. It was so intense and clear, however, that I actually gasped, although probably no one else noticed my in-breath or the fact that I started slightly with an involuntary spasm. It was the first time this vision had been so powerfully and convincingly clear to me. So, this particular individual was, in a certain way, given an invitation that that particular vision might show up for them during this voyaging space. And they, in fact, saw it. But it was momentary. It was just a momentary sensing of something. That sometimes is all we can get. And so you grab those. You grab them with better attention when you're there. When they are occurring, work with your attention at that time. Those are the moments to garner. So on the one hand, it seems as if when we go to a certain level, we're able to see the horror of the situation and know its reality. The creation is dead. Just as the machine is asleep, only the scale is so grand, so absolutely enormous, that it is a source of horror for us, for itself and for its progenitor, and its eternal companion, the Absolute, once removed. The more we look at this dead creation, the more horrible it becomes, the more overwhelming and frightening. The realization that the Absolute is, in a sense, totally practicing necrophilia can be thoroughly terrifying, utterly devastating. How can one be prepared to make love to a truly cold, limp, dead thing? In the chamber at the top, where the whole of creation is visible and quite lifeless, a knowledge of the enormity of what is involved here comes and goes. At once, this huge, monstrous creature called creation, and at the same time a solid entity with no reference to scale but itself, therefore relatively small from its subjective point of view. It isn't just the deadness of creation, it seems filled with fear of life. Just as our human biological machines have the fear of waking, of the waking state, only on an unimaginably vast scale. We as shamanic voyagers wish to give creation the habit of coming to life so that it is no longer so antithetical to it. So from that point of view, we can practice this sense of the creation is dead because we're asleep too. Watch what occurs when we place our attention on it and the machine starts to come to life and there's some vigor there because of it. Something has occurred at that time. on that scale, we can experience it. We can experience the sense of the creation is dead. Well, we are. Now scale that around and watch about you, and you can see how that is. The voyage of that particular night was an attempt at bringing the creation to life. Several attempts were made, much as one strikes flint on steel over and over again until a spark is generated. Then, with some help of gentle, continuous fanning, perhaps a small flame, wavering, hesitant, uncertain, flickers and finally catches for a moment or two. The hope is that one day it'll really take, so that at last, although this wonderful flame of life, even though eternal, would not be entirely permanent, because all living things, even on such a scale, must die. Life, after all, is breath, and the out-breath surely follows in-breath. From this point of view, I was told afterward by UJ himself, in response to a direct question, that the voyage was success. The creation did come to life, even though briefly. I did not see it, however. Hopefully next time, I will not be so blind. Can you see any of the comments, Susan?
Let's see. I see Lost Horizon asked if the creation is afraid to come to life.
It's immaterial. It's a good question. All these questions are good questions. But one thing we can do is we can say, what can we do to bring the creation that I'm involved in to life? Because as you begin to do that, there's a vibratory response. And the vibratory response comes about because of our focus of attention. And then the focus of attention might bring something back. Or not. We don't know. But to attribute fear to it, attributes in a certain way human characteristics to it. And in that case, I just don't know. I don't know how to answer that, Lost Horizon.
Well, and Aura says that creation doesn't know it's dead.
Of course it doesn't. Exactly
right.
It's
just like being asleep.
When we are asleep, we're not saying, gosh, I'm asleep. We're asleep. Until you get to a place where when you sense the machine going to sleep, it actually acts as a wake-up reminder. That happens a little later.
Simon Singh is about this when Spinoza said that God is dead.
No. Spinoza is not the one that said God is dead. Spinoza said eternal being, and that if we become extremely clear, he calls it salvation.
And then
he says, become clear like that, we see, as it were, through the eyes of God for a moment. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, he was adding Nietzsche.
Yeah. Nietzsche is the one that said that later.
Yes.
300 years later.
And there were some good questions. I'm unable to scroll back up to the beginning of the class.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
Well, we're with the tools that we have. and we're working with those tools. And the tools say, you have the opportunity to work on your own. How can you do that work then with your fellow voyagers, your fellow people that you can work with around you? It may not be very obvious, but sometimes staying by yourself, then maybe you need to reach out. Maybe there's somebody looking for you.
Well, and when you have others or a group, then there's things that didn't occur to you or ways to look at things. Even in this passage that you read, although, you know, the details made it hard to keep my attention.
Yeah.
It still shows, you know, there is another way to look at it. There is, we can see from each other how other people do it.
Correct. And then, but also I want to urge everybody, you are on your own. You are on your own. There's nobody else that's suddenly going to say, oh, here, or just come here and then it'll all be taken care of. No, you're on your own out there. Work on your own as well as you can to increase this vibratory sensation so that it's an integral part of your life. You will then be compelled to find ways and means to group with other people, because when you do that, particularly if they're like-minded people, there's just more juice there when that occurs. There's just more juice. And in that case, you can go deeper into it, and these ideas of this concept of understanding becomes much deeper then, much deeper.
Well, I do find with the group that it feeds me.
Yeah. So, at the very end it says, not all voyages are concerned with bringing creation to life. Voyages of this type are. So the next part that's up is actually the epilogue, or the last chapter we're going to cover. I'm not 100% sure whether I'm going to be. I have to travel this weekend. I'm not sure if I'll be back by Wednesday, but I'll let you know one way or another. And we should, we really... This is an opportunity. It's like, how do you work together? How do you work together? How do you bring these tools into not only your life, but other people's lives too, that are looking for something? Anyway, I don't know what else to say on that regard.
Have you thought of a next book?
No, I have not. No, and I guess people can offer suggestions if they'd like, if we want to continue doing this.
Well, I for one would.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I thought of the idea of self-completion by Robert Dorop. I don't know if that's an option or...
Well,
do you want to stay focused on EJ? Or?
I haven't explored the idea of books other than EJ's books. But, yeah. Oh, there's another vote for Robert Dorop's book here. But if we went into other literature, then I think it opens up a number of different possibilities. So
it's true. I do, in one respect, though, I do think that is kind of an exception because it is also endorsed by EJ? I'll leave it at that.
Thank you for that. So, I don't know if there's any other questions, or maybe we should just call it a night for the moment. So thank you for coming again, and we'll look forward to seeing you most likely next week. Good night.